Jonathan, how are you, my man?
Fine, thanks.
We always like to start with where are you in the world and what is it like there today?
Currently, I'm in Tel Aviv in Israel. Generally winterish, but still short sleeves.
Nice. I got a fun one for you to start with. When it comes to Web3 and blockchains, what is an orphan? What is an uncle? What is the difference and why do they matter?
So it begins with blockchain being naturally a chain of blocks, as the name hints. This was the original Bitcoin protocol. And the need for a chain comes from Bitcoin protocol being a synchronous one. So when you think about synchronous protocols, you think of a protocol that requires, roughly speaking, all participants to agree on the previous round before proceeding to the next round. A chain protocol is typically a sequential or a synchronous protocol. And around 2015, 2014, we came up with a more general paradigm, we being my advisor, Aviv Zohar, myself, and other co-authors in the Hume University, which enables looking at other blocks that are not on the chain. Now, when you, and I'll get shortly to the difference between uncle and orphans, the motivation for this is not when you have a slow protocol. So when you have a slow chain that keeps synchrony intact, then you're not motivated to look at orphans or at off-chain blocks. But if you want to accelerate block creation, and we can touch on the motivations for that, then you go outside the realm of synchrony and you allow for parallel mining to mine blocks in parallel. And this process results in blocks that are not on a chain. Now, if it's a rare occurrence, then you don't really mind and you can orphan them. If it's less rare, then you want to start considering these blocks in your consensus. So the terminology is in slow protocols like Bitcoin, then you ignore off-chain blocks, you discard them, and then you insult them with being an orphan. So you just discard them.
Okay.
And if you do want to consider them in faster chains, such as Ethereum, which I believe had a block every 12 seconds, maybe 13, I don't remember exactly, then you start getting a non-negligible off-chain rate or orphan rate. And then you want to consider these blocks. To what end you consider them, you can consider them in the consensus, as our protocols did, but you can consider them merely for giving them, granting them rewards. The motivation here being just to be more fair, be more decentralized, not cause latecomers to lose all the proof of work. So in Ethereum, the treatment of orphan blocks is more, I would say, tolerant, and they grant them rewards, and accordingly, they don't call them orphans, they call them uncles. This is the origin of the terms, but this is not encompassing the entire idea of treating off-chain blocks. This is a wider topic, which I can get into.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And no, I was looking at some of the things last night and I liked the term uncle. And then I saw like the quote, like in Vitalik's like original Bitcoin magazine blog post, like he mentions Ghost, right? Which is like that was the paper that you had written. I think you had a partner on that paper. But I guess something that kind of thought was interesting was it comes down to latency, right? If you're like within a consensus, if there's a consensus mechanism, so with Bitcoin, someone solves, one miner solves what's going on, and then it's like they have to broadcast that, right? And if you could almost like asynchronously broadcast that or instantaneously broadcast that, even in a way, then there's going to be a lower probability of an orphan, right? But since that's like, that was like even like the problem with the latency. But then I think that's what you guys came up with, right? Was that, I think you called it like the heaviest chain wins. I'm a miner and I'm over here and I've just solved like for this block, right? And then I broadcast that. And then in that time it takes to get the broadcast to that other miner, they've actually solved it too, or they think they've solved it, but they haven't solved it as fast. What you're saying is, as a, like you guys said, as opposed to just dropping that orphan and saying, hey, you get nothing for almost solving it because you're now broadcasting to other miners that you've done it, you're now appended to that in a way. You're earning the rewards from that chain because you have also solved it, but like just slower than the other one. And so it came to me of saying, man, it's all about this latency, right?
Sure. So it is about latency. And the consideration of latency is, of course, not new. This is the crux of designing any consensus protocol, any agreement protocol on the network. boils down to the question, what do you know about the latency? Do you assume a hard bound inside the protocol, which is called technically a synchronous protocol? Do you not assume that? You just let the miners or the consensus participants figure it out? The point about Ghost was not to incentivize, to reward, so to speak, compensate the late miner, as you described. This was more described in our other paper, Inclusive Blockchain Protocols. And as I mentioned, this was indeed implemented in Ethereum, this concept. To consider the proof of work that miner contributed to, in the heart of consensus, to order things, to order the ledger differently. So in the most general case, let's just forget about what we know about Bitcoin or Ethereum. Just imagine miners mining blocks very frequently. Let's go wild. Let's go 100 blocks per second. So it's not just a matter of paying who and being fair to who. It sounds like a more risky system and more messy system, right? It's chaotic. And it's very intuitive with 100 blocks per second to understand that picking the longest chain, as Bitcoin and as Ethereum do, regardless of what you're paying others, is inherently insecure. So consider an attacker that has a data center and does not suffer from latency. So this attacker can control 10%, 5% of the hash rate, and still possess the longest chain, right? Because it doesn't suffer from latency, while all the honest nodes are distributed and create this messy graph of blocks, right? So can you imagine like 100 blocks per second, a messy graph, a messy data structure of blocks, which technically can be called a DAG, but this is more of a general picture, just picture a mess of blocks and then one smart attacker just creating a longer chain with no latency and winning it all. So obviously you don't want that to happen. And what you do want is you want a more sophisticated chain selection or block ordering, or more generally, a more sophisticated algorithm to order this graph of blocks. And this chain, this protocol cannot be the longest chain. Technically, what you want, the property that even if the attacker suffers from zero latency and the honest network suffers from very substantial latency, the attacker cannot manipulate the ordering. So we can get into the technical definitions, but this is more the intuition behind the parallelized consensus or asynchronous or block DAG paradigm.
I want to continue into that, but I do want to take a step back. What makes you passionate about solving some of this stuff around blockchain or around consensus mechanisms? What is the kind of the driving mission for you? And like, where did you start your career? Like, how has your kind of career unfolded? Like going to college, coming out of college, working, doing research. It looks like you're doing some research and some work at Harvard now. So how has it all unfolded for you? What makes you passionate about the space?
That's a great question for me personally to reflect on. I guess, like many people, my career unfolded by coincidence or by destiny that I wasn't planning on. I did my math undergrad in the Hume University. Then I went to computer science for grad school. I met Aviv Zohar, which came from, I think it was a Microsoft. And then I started a lab project with him. I was initially more interested in the probability theory aspects of the task that he presented me with. I was mainly still a mathematician at that time when we published Ghost. And in fact, the parts of the paper that I was interested at and I was excited about were pushed by Aviv into the appendix. You know, no one really reads them today. It took me time to convert, but from the outset, I was very motivated by, and still motivated by, the aesthetics of the problem. So it's still mainly an academic passion, an aesthetic passion for taking this graph of blocks. Someone tells you 51% are honest, and someone tells you you're allowed to assume something about the latency, and depending on that something, you should provide an ordering of the DAG, which has well-defined properties. So it began with a theoretical interest. With time, I converted to the crypto religion and more fundamental principles, but it still remained for me an aesthetic pursuit. More concretely, around 2000, beginning of 2018, I co-founded DAG Labs, whose mission was to, at that time, to commercialize the DAG protocols. It was seed funded by Polychain and then other VCs, and it kind of shifted from academia to startup mode. And at this period, I completed my PhD at the Hume University. Towards the end of this process, I kind of together with other folks, realized that the commercialization path of proof of work doesn't really make sense. And we kind of shifted to a fair launch and dissolved the entity, at which time I continued with an academic career and went to Harvard for a postdoc.
It seems like you've been solving this math problem for a really long time, or just passionate about solving it. And now you're kind of coming out and saying, we have a decent solve that we feel comfortable with. Let's commercialize it in some sort of way. Is that kind
It started with mathematical pursuit, and the nature of the problems did change. It's not that we are trying to solve, or that I'm trying to think about the same problem for I don't know, 8 years now. The problems have changed. They became more sophisticated, more nuanced. And of course, I wouldn't, it's not only mathematics for me now, by now. As I said, I converted to the crypto religion after maybe a year or two. And by now, it's a broader belief in the value of crypto. And it's not only a mathematical pursuit. Otherwise, I wouldn't be that involved in the industry.
What would you say the broader belief in crypto is for you?
I would say that crypto has two flags broadly. One is a stateless money base, monetary system, which was, of course, put forth by Satoshi. And the second one is an open financial system, which was the basically the message of Ethereum, of Vitalik. This message was less political when Ethereum came out. It was more of an exciting concept, and the messaging was less political. But if you think about it more profoundly, these are the two pillars of crypto: stateless money base and an open financial system. I can elaborate on both.
Yeah. So tell me what, like, you know, there's some people out there that might say Bitcoin's perfect the way that it is, right? And it the fact that it's unchanging is the magic behind it, right? And that it's, you know, the longest running, for more, lack of a better term, computer system that's, you know, had 100% uptime, you know, since its inception. Like, there's a place for that. And I think that that's important. It seems like you might be saying, you know, hey, I think that there's a little bit more here for this open financial system that we need to continue to investigate, because Bitcoin's kind of doing its thing. There's not as much innovation over there as there can be with this kind of open financial system. And this open financial system has some of the similar first principle things that can be solved or changed, I guess, from that standpoint. And so it seems like that's kind of where your passion's leading you.
So it boils down to the question still around the first principle of stateless money, whether there's room for more than one coin, mm-hmm. whether there's a justification. It's not clear that, you know, the answer is not a clear yes or resounding yes. Of course, you know, you should have a field of thousands of coins, but you still need to think, okay, so is there room for maybe three, 5 points on the trade-off? Because Bitcoin has a very specific point at the trade-off. And of course, it's the maybe rightmost extreme of conservative development, which you can argue, it's a fair argument, that this is the maybe the sole property that a stateless money system should have. But I think since then, the prevailing view has softened. So when Litecoin came out, you know, Bitcoin maxis really, really opposed it and thought this is really, really outrageous, superfluous, if not outrageous, project. And then as other projects came in the storm of ICOs and other less justifiable projects came through, the view of Litecoin has been softer. And for the reason that with the conservative extreme of Bitcoin, you're sort of stuck on an arbitrary point on the extreme point, but it like snapshots an arbitrary point in history, how the code was written in 2008, what the assumptions of the network were by then, what were the technological and scientific understandings at the time. You're kind of stuck with that. This seems like an arbitrary point to fixate our entire movement and our entire money, crypto money, on that specific point in time. With that said, indeed, I wasn't, and I'm still not taking it lightly to invent another coin. This is where the importance of community comes in. I wasn't very comfortable with, you know, pushing, you know, selling coins. We didn't do any ICO, we didn't do any pre-mine, among other reasons, for that reason. it needs to be a community project, not so much for the ideology, but more this is the way to justify that the project sort of, there's a feedback loop and justifies itself, rather than an organizational corporation or a centralized, you know, marketing team just invents a new you know, store of value and or medium exchange and starts promoting it. This is, you know, on empty air. So this was the kind of considerations we took when we did a fair launch and when we kind of let the community develop organically.
I like how eloquently you said the, like, just less justifiable projects came out. I think that's a very, very nice way of talking about the market. I think I might steal that from you. And so, you know, you have, so let's talk about Caspa, right? Like let's talk a little bit about, like, you talked, you know, hey, we started to kind of come up with this different type of consensus. Like, obviously you've been working on that problem, trying to solve some of this stuff for a long time. At some point you hit this juncture where you say, wow, like, I think I've kind of solved something that I feel comfortable telling the world about, right? Like, I've got the math is down the page far enough and you've spent enough time and you're like, okay, this is at least better than what I've seen out in the market. I want to go. Like, where did you get, you know, in that kind of process, and what was the inflection point where you're like, okay, we think that this is something that we want to bring to the world. What is that as it stands today in the world?
At that time, there weren't any serious competitors to that concept. It was Spectre Protocol, which was already out there and proven, you know, co-authored by myself and Aviv and Neil Ad. And then during the founding of DAG Labs, we worked on Phantom Protocol. And the conviction comes from completing the paper and knowing you covered the weak points and the sensitive points, and from peer review. So you kind of send it to peer review. It doesn't need to be necessarily officially accepted by a conference. More, you get reviews from folks in the community, in the academic community, and you kind of gauge whether there's a profound challenge or problem or error in your protocol, or, you know, maybe it's rejected or accepted according to the presentation, etc. So it's more an academic process. And whether this is, again, whether the industry is interested and wants it to be developed or not, this is more inbound demand. It's not that I came and started converting people to the block DAG paradigm. It's more gauging that there's enough demand and people want to hear more about it. And again, at that time, there weren't any serious contenders to block DAG paradigm. By block DAG paradigm, I mean asynchronous proof of work.
Where is the true layer one at right now? I mean, do we have a test net?
So we launched mainnet on November 2021, I believe.
Okay.
We launched through proof of work. We kind of decided on the proof of work a few days before the launch on the Discord community channel and started mining, and people joined. Since then, the hash rate grew, both the mining and the developer community grew. And the mainnet is following the GhostDAG or Phantom protocol. I don't recall exactly, but around 2018 or 19, we completed a Phantom GhostDAG paper. And then November 21, we launched the mainnet.
Like you said, it was like a last minute decision to go proof of work.
To choose the proof of work function.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's important to emphasize this. Deciding the proof of work function is the main advantage you can or cannot have when you're deciding on things. If we decided on proof of work function half a year before launch, then we would have been able to designate it hardware, or at least very efficient GPUs for that matter. So it is a sensitive point to decide what the proof of work is.
Ethereum, you know, they've been spending the last couple of years trying to like move to proof of stake, right? And there's, you know, there's this conversation that's also been out there about the amount of energy that it takes for proof of work. You know, obviously if you're coming up with a much more efficient mechanism to like operate and to have the consensus of proof of work, you know, what are we looking at here when you think about how many miners are out there and what do they need? Like, how are they mining with, are they using GPUs? Are they like, how is some of the mining happening right now? And when you said that everyone was, you're overwhelmed with the, like the amount of people that came out to kind of participate, like where, like are these people located all around the world? Like how are they participating?
Okay. So a few questions here.
Yeah. Sorry. I kind of do multi-point questions a lot because sometimes I'm thinking just in my head.
Fair enough. I'll start with I'll start like a stack with what I remember from the last part of your questions. So regarding where the miners are coming from, I wouldn't know. It began with CPU miners, people just running clusters of CPU. Then a GPU was developed by a community member, and then FPGAs. So the kind of I guess currently it's a network of mainly GPUs and then a few clusters of FPGAs. The miners are not mostly, I guess, are active in the Discord. They're not anonymous, but I don't think their location and an identity is revealed. And they're definitely around the globe. So we have in Caspa, the community created channels, help channels in many, many languages. Vietnam, Indonesia, Japan, Russian. There's like multiple, lots of help channels in many languages. So it's definitely around the globe. And another point about where the miners came from. So a few months before the merge, someone developed a dual miner for Ethereum and Caspa. And at that time, the hash rate really spiked. So Ethereum miners, at least many Ethereum miners, joined the mining of Caspa through that software. So that's on the context of where Caspa miners and the Caspa mining network. Regarding the broader point of proof of work, proof of stake, and and the energy concerns of proof of work. So before I say my stance on this, I'll say there are generally two camps in proof of work. One camp is promoting proof of work as the only legitimate way to distribute new money. So, having an external source of pegging to the cost that you had in generating this money, and this being the electricity and the difficulty adjustment of this electricity representing the supply demand. So this is the new money distribution camp. Another camp is the camp that emphasizes the security, the decentralization, the anonymity of miners, the fact that proof of stake stems from a known centralized entity that allocated who knows how much percentages to entities with defined incentives, which are typically not conflicting enough, right? In proof of work, you have these miners that are very competitive and with conflicting interests. And this is what makes the system very, I would say, anti-fragile, to use this buzz description. Whereas in proof of stake, things are more coordinated economically, and there's concern about whether this truly constitutes a decentralized network. So these are the two camps about proof of work. Where I personally stand is I'm more on the first camp, where the distribution of money is the important part of where the proof of work is really crucial for the growth. And I do have concerns about the political scalability of proof of work. So even if all of our claims about proof of work not being bad or not being wasteful in some philosophical sense that we can argue about, even if these claims are correct, it's still not feasible to convince the general mass about this. And politicians would easily shift the public opinion against proof of work, regardless of its merits. So I do think in the long term, some solution needs to be presented with more conviction to the general mass. In Caspa, we took the path of choosing a proof of work function that is friendly to optical ASICs. Optical ASICs is a field that I'm far from being an expert on, but the gist of it is there's these optical chips for general computing, not for general computation problem, not only for proof of work, which are, again, supposedly, because I'm not an expert in the field, which are supposedly energy efficient. They are more capital intense in the sense that it costs a lot to manufacture such ASICs, such hardware. But the electricity, there's almost no electricity consumption because it's based on light interaction, not on electrons. So the proof of work function of CASPA is optical ASIC friendly, but this is not to say that we currently have optical ASICs or someone has. There are talks in the community about developing them, but we can just hope that this will happen.
Yeah, it's like, as the technology advances and like energy becomes potentially more ubiquitous at some point, hopefully free, that also gets solved, and I think it's like on a long enough timeline, it all gets solved. When it comes to it, I agree with you. I think there's something, it's almost like, could you really truly have a stateless money with a proof of stake system? Right. Doesn't seem like you can. And so is that what you envision CASPA to start as here? Is it trying to be a stateless money, almost competition to Bitcoin?
It's already a stateless money, and we're definitely very resilient against regulation because there's literally no centralized entity to go after. Even if someone does something, unfortunately wrong, there's really no one to shut down. I'm not an admin in the community. There's too many points of anchors in the community to shut down a single entity or to pursue legally. So in that term, in that sense, we are already stateless money. I forgot your second point.
Yeah, no, I mean, is that the vision? Is that say, hey, we put this out into the world and, I'm just a community member and we kind of see what happens. Was that kind of the intent from the beginning? Was like, hey, there deserves to be a competition to a Bitcoin. And there could be, like you were saying at the beginning, maybe two, maybe three of these in a way. It doesn't necessarily need to be one. Has that been the vision?
Yeah. So we're following Satoshi's principles when he created Bitcoin, or maybe I said when she created Bitcoin, but I don't see it as a competition to Bitcoin. Again, it's a competition only if you believe that there's a single point in the trade-off of when designing a system. So, we named CASPA silver. CASPA is an ancient Aramaic silver. This was the meme of Litecoin, if you remember.
Yep. It's even the silver, like the coin, like it's a silver coin.
Yeah, exactly. So in the ancient world, silver was exactly a coin with a different trade-off versus gold. It was less precious, but more convenient as a medium of exchange for reasons, I wasn't alive at that time. But so even in the ancient world, money was, money, you had several money, monies, due to the need to have different trade-offs. So I don't see this as a competition to Bitcoin. And again, this doesn't mean we can envision dozens of proof of work coins. I don't think that would be a good vision. I would guess, it's my own taste that there wouldn't be more than there isn't a place for more than five top 10 money bundles of money attributes that are justifiable, justifiably to be that are justified to be separate. So for instance, so CASPA has currently one block per second. We will upgrade it to have eight blocks per second and hopefully more if we find it, if the math works well. Now, this doesn't mean that if we have an eight block per second system, then, and someone else wants to have a 12 blocks per second system, then they should launch a new layer one. It's, you need to have some broader a vision of a bundle of properties that you want to have. So if you ask me about the bundle of properties that Caspa has and aspires to maintain, it would be optimizing the speed of confirmations, the confirmation times, and keeping the, while keeping the same principles of Satoshi system. So proof of work, block, transaction fees, UTXO, you know, set being the minimal scripting language that is you know, secure for verification, etc. So all in all, it's following Satoshi's and Bitcoin's principles, but I wouldn't describe it as competition per se.
Okay. Well, I mean, in a way where it's, everything is a competition for attention, right? But you're saying it wasn't, it's not out to, nothing's out to like directly replace Bitcoin. You're saying, hey, we think that this is, Bitcoin will have its place, because like you're saying, the community, and at the end of the day, like Bitcoin hasn't changed, right? And we can say that like the technology probably is, you know, a little, actually more antiquated, right, than some of the things that are out there, but it's still going to maintain a lot of value because it's a, basically a religion at this point, you know, believing in Bitcoin and being a part of that. It's like, it's almost kind of interesting too, that we don't know who the founder is either. And it's this kind of mysterious thing that's out there, right? It's like, that's, it's kind of aligns pretty well with like, almost like what a religion would align with. And there's a lot of community built around that. And so, I mean, it's almost like there's no other option outside of a fair launch proof of work system that could even and should even be able to compete and become usable by a large mass of people. My question, I guess, on that is, why do you think other, like with everyone going to proof of stake, like I like where you're thinking about having this, where it's positioned, especially right now with where Bitcoin is at. And there's a lot of miners out there. There's a lot of machines sitting out there that people are maybe looking to point at something. So it's good timing on your part. I don't know if that was on purpose or by, you know, the stars aligning, but you know, why do you think other folks haven't gone and tried to build something in this vein?
I would first say that I'm not sure, pardon my heresy, I'm not sure Bitcoin community is that vibrant and that attractive at this point in time. So it seems that interest in the community has, in Bitcoin, the money, yeah, it's still the king of collateral, but I'm not sure it will stay that way. But the conservative development has really pushed away people, even people that are enthusiastic about proof of work and these principles. There's not a lot of room for development. There's not a lot of room for participation. I'm not a big fan of Lightning Network. And I would say, okay, so if you're a young dev and you were converted to crypto religion, what do you really have to do in Bitcoin circles? Even if you believe, you know, this is the, even if you're a maxi in your soul, what will you really do in that environment? So that's why I think every few years, there's like a new proof of work community. So it started with Bitcoin and then Litecoin, Monero, Grin, and then Caspa. So the previous communities are graveyards for developers and people that are very enthusiastic about the same principles, but they don't really have a way to participate. So in that sense, Bitcoin, it's a religion. I'm not sure it's an attractive one to the masses. And also one of its strength points, and you know, it's the beauty of having an anonymous founder does make, and as well as other agendas of the hardcore, you know, Bitcoin, you know, elitism, has pushed the masses away from Bitcoin. Again, you think of Ethereum is much more attractive to people, among other reasons, because there's a face to idolize. And we can like it or not, but it's more appealing to the masses. Now, I'm not pushing for that kind of idealization. And I do wish the founder of Casper was anonymous and definitely faithless. But in general, the elitist religion of Bitcoin has really kept it a small circle, right? So concretely, if you're not running your full node and you're not storing your own keys, you're not part of us, right? Yep. If you're not, it's a very fundamentalist religion, which doesn't, you know, it's like there's no Protestants in Bitcoin.
That's an interesting way to think about it. It's true though. And yeah. And just kind of thinking about like as a founder, as someone that's put a paper out and then had kind of this fair launch and everything. I mean, how do you think about continuing to upgrade? Right. And like the big part about Ethereum is the simplicity of a solidity, and anyone can participate and they can build a company on top of that. They can build a NFT. They can build like a community. They can crowdsource and buy a theme park. They can do, there's the endless innovation that kind of comes out of that. And so how are you thinking about a proof of work, like UTXO blockchain, public blockchain, fair launch? Like, how are you thinking about having people being able to participate like that? And how does the innovation continue to get driven?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we are still in the innovative part of the base layer, but long-term, even a year from now, we should already be thinking about this application layer, precisely because of the points you mentioned. If you want to have, there's only that much you can innovate, not in a centralized manner, but in a focused manner, like a core team that is not officially a team, but a team of core members that are focused on the base layer. There's only that much you can innovate. You can push the system to its limits. And then going forward, we will have to create this, add this rich application layer that's enabled by smart contracts. If I may give you a teaser about what is going on in Casper development. So recently, Michael Sutton and I published a paper that's called the Dagnite Protocol. So Michael he did a master's degree in the Hebrew University, and he worked in Dag Labs, and currently his kind of an unofficial tech lead or core dev of Caspa. And we worked nearly for 3 years now on this protocol, which we call Dagnite. And to recall things that we started the meeting with, so Dagnite has the property that it can order the graph of blocks, the DAG, without knowing anything about the latency. So our previous protocol, Phantom Ghost DAG, had this a priori bound over the latency. So we had to assume, okay, the network, in the worst case, will not suffer from a latency greater than 10 seconds per block message, just as an example, but that's also how we instantiated it. Now, in Dagnite, we do not assume that. We let miners, so there's a difficult adjustment protocol, of course. You can't let miners mine infinite blocks, a number of blocks per second. But other than that, the protocol does not know in advance what the latency is. This is kind of very exciting challenge. This gives you the flavor of how come we're working on the same problem for several years. It's because the problem is we upped, so to speak, the challenge. So the challenge now is to order a DAG without knowing anything about the latency. And hopefully this will be the next stage of development. And the process of development in Casper is basically you ask for a grant from the community, and Casper whales, maybe also Casper dolphins, are contributing to that grant, and then the relevant members go on and implement it, and they get the Casper from some dev fund, which again, it's a few Discord members hold the funds. It's a very kind of fun community and still feeling of a village.
How do you validate or verify that someone is capable of contributing to the code base or upgrading, or if they want to go build something kind of separate, like if they submit a proposal? Right. Like, how is the voting done? Is it vote, like you're saying, like someone's mining, they're out there, there's a whale that has like the most miners, and they're like, oh, this upgrade needs to be done, or this adjustment needs to be made. sure, that sounds great and they contribute capital towards that, but how, is there some sort of verification process to make sure that that person, whether they're anonymous or not, right, can actually do what they're saying that they could do?
So again, we're still a village in village mode. So it's you typically know the interested, the developers' names or at least usernames. Mm-hmm. And they don't get the funds if they do not complete the milestones that were in the grant. So this ensures that people do not...
So they actually have to do the work first and then submit the work and they get paid if the work's good.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it's not, again, we're a young community. So it's not that I have like a dozen of examples to provide. It's still basically people know who's who. I for one, do not know who the dev fund holders are. I can discover who they are, but I'm not interested in that. But people have a kind of a good understanding of who the developers are, who's contributing. And I don't think it's very different than, I would say, how Bitcoin works, how Bitcoin development works. You can't, someone submits a PR on GitHub, you go over the code, you check whether they did something sensible or not.
And so just to kind of talk a little bit more about like the innovation that could be built around Caspa, like you talked about, like the latency piece and, you know, so what does that open up? Does that open up the ability for anyone to then, you know, launch some sort of value that's appended to the chain in some way? How does that solve, actually create this innovation here of, I want to go create a decentralized exchange of like Caspa and something potentially built on top of that, or I want to launch something like, does it, just talking in traditional terms here of what's currently built in the Web3 space right now, is that going to be possible? Or are you saying, hey, Caspa is just going to keep churning and keep moving, people can contribute and we're going to keep it interesting and those developers can continue to contribute to Caspa, but it's not smart contracting?
So again, my personal view is, and it doesn't need to be, I'm not representing the entire community because people can have different agendas and fund different agendas. So even if I oppose developing smart contracts today, tomorrow someone can open a grant and, you know, the Kickstart campaign can fill despite my opinion. But since I'm here, I'll share with you my opinion. I think that, again, long-term, we have to develop smart contracts. This is the second pillar of crypto, in my opinion, the open financial system, not only for attracting devs, but also for realizing that value, that value proposition. I do think that since the field is saturated, and since Ethereum is still an innovating community with all of its problems, we do need we or any project that develops a smart contract platform does need to have either a unique value proposition with the way smart contracts are built, or to have a concrete adoption strategy. Without either, I find it difficult to justify the creation of smart contracts because it's just easier to bridge to Ethereum and build it there. I do think there is lots of room to innovate on smart contracts, not only in the application layer, in the swapping, Uniswap, SushiSwap, or whatever financial game you want to invent. There is lots of room to innovate within smart contracts. I do not think, there's the true and complete meme that you could sort of do everything with smart contracts, but I think there are still parts that are inherently limited in the expressiveness of smart contracts as they are constructed today. So I do hope to come up with a unique value proposition and a unique structuring of smart contracts in a way that will sort of self-justify the creation of smart contracts. Not that is the end goal. The end goal is to research things that I'm interested at, but it so happens to be that the things I'm interested at are related to the way smart contracts are interacting with transactions. And to be a bit more explicit, there's this whole MEV field, which I'm sure you heard of, which is the manipulation of the ordering of transactions. This kind of caught the attention of the entire Ethereum community. and for good reasons, because MEV, MEV is basically like algo trading on crypto.
Yeah.
And the reason this is catching the attention is because you can think of the first decade of crypto, you know, in the crypto research, as we're dealing with how to order blocks, or how to order confirmed transactions, how to order transactions that came on the, that were published on the ledger, be it proof of stake, proof of work, Bitcoin protocol, Ghost protocol, whatever your protocol is. This was the research, you know, double spending attacks, selfish mining attacks, all these kinds of manipulations, on the ledger structure. Then with the advent of these financial manipulations and flash bots and MEV, what happened is the entire, we kind of reached a level where these small optimizations catch lots of value. And these are optimizations that are in the mempool. So it's the ordering of transactions from zero confirmations to one, rather than from one confirmation to, you know, to 10, rather than focusing on the reorgs and you know, how to make sure the ledger is not reversed. Now you're focusing on how transactions are ordered from the mempool to the ledger. And this is a fascinating field. And I think the reason there's lots of room to innovate here in a different path than Ethereum took is because the prevailing agenda or viewpoint in Ethereum community, I should say flashbots are the center of that is that you should democratize MEV. You can't prevent it, you should democratize it. So the tools, you know, recently the open sourced their code, you know, these tools are designed not to prevent it, not to protect the user, but to democratize the manipulation. And there's, of course, lots of arguments whether this is a necessary evil, whether this helps the market, if this ruins the market, you know, very resembling the proof of work argument. You know, one camp says proof of work saves the planet, the other one says it destroys the planet. So kind of MEV is, you know, now there's the same two opposing camps. And this is the field where I think there's lots of interesting problems to work on, and where innovation can come about, you know, regardless of the specifics of CASPA. Of course, I hope CASPA will adopt these directions.
Okay, I've got a fun one for you. Do you know how much it would cost right now to create a 51% attack on Bitcoin?
No, but I read it a few weeks ago, so I fell drastically.
Yeah, it's fun a lot. I did it. I ran it back in like January 2021. It was like I got like construction and mining equipment alone, and it was about like 1.1 trillion. And so I just like stopped the math. But it's like when you think
for a few trillions of dollars.
Yeah, it was 1.1 trillion, and that was like just for like construction.
And a few hundreds of million.
No, and then that construction and mining equipment together. It was like, hey, if you can facilitate the like the actual that I didn't even get to like the like actual payment of power. I just got to construction of actual, can you get these things together, bunch them up together and start, what is the hash rate that would be needed to get there? And I didn't even get to the part where I was like, oh, I now have to go determine how much power I'd have to buy for it.
So what's the figure you came up with?
It was $1.109 trillion for just that. And I thought that it seemed insurmountable in order to go and kind of create that. But you seem to probably have, I thought maybe you'd run that as well and like had kind of thought about that, and maybe it was a little bit easier in your mind.
It's surprisingly high, this estimation.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I think it's lower now than it was back then. But I was literally thinking about, you know, you have to get the containers and like it cool, air cooling, you know, thinking about the actual like construction, like it was like estimated. Yes. There was a lot more to it than just like, oh, like, hey, if all the miners and everything was all in place, how much would the power cost? Those numbers are a lot different. So
here's a challenge for you.
Okay.
Assume I'm a Bitcoin miner and I'm here for a few years now, and my hardware is no longer efficient. So I do have a mining farm. And I had ASICs running for a few years now, and now I want to exit the network. So now that I do have the equipment, but I'm stopping Bitcoin mining because it's no longer profitable for me. I'm going to mine Casper. So one moment before I shut down my mining farm, a malicious thought can come to my mind, since I anyways invested the capital expenses. And since the only reason I'm shutting down is because I'm epsilon below the profitability threshold, might I not launch a 51% attack? Cost me much. It's no purely capital expense calculation. It could be the capital expenses were already invested.
Right. And that's, I think Satoshi in the white paper wrote, there's a line about that where it says, at which point a 51% attack becomes the goal, the incentive to just be mining Bitcoin should be so profitable that someone wouldn't make that decision. But
it's no longer profitable for me because my hardware ran for a few years and I'm losing the game anyway.
And so what you're saying is like at which moment you're completely set up and the cost has been sunk and the profit has been made, that changes the thought process at that very moment that like maybe you make a couple of phone calls. I get it.
I would guess, I'm not an expert, but I would guesstimate 51% attacking Bitcoin would cost today less than $1 billion. But again, you're right that taking into account the capital expenses is a must when you think about security. Yeah. And then you need to think about the considerations that I brought up and mesh them together somehow. I think it will be an average somewhere. We can meet in the middle.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. If like everything's already set up and in place, it's a very different number. Sure. Then if I was sitting here at day one, starting from scratch, going, what would I do?
The reasoning behind the security that ASICs provide goes along the lines that you proposed, right? That the capital expenses are high and people are, as you mentioned from the Satoshi white paper, I just brought that point to poke a hole in your argument. But of course, it's more along the lines of capital expense security.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's why you're solving these problems. Maybe tell us just a little bit in the time that we have here, what's it been like running this community now, or just being a part of this community, being in the Discord? I always find it interesting being in the space, working with folks on Discord that like I don't know who they are, right? Like they have an NFT as an avatar, but you can tell they're really passionate and really smart about what they're doing. I don't know if they have a job at Google or if they're working somewhere else, but they're just really passionate about what's going on. What's it been like for you? Is that a part of why you love being in the space? Is you're invigorated by like the community of people that are around you that are cheerleading? You have a lot of cheerleaders in the chat right here. It's more than I've seen the last couple of live streams we've had. So congrats on creating a nice community here. So what's it been like for you?
For me, I regret not doing it earlier. If I knew it, that communities can grow that organically, if I had faith in that as I have by now, I would have done it years earlier. And indeed, it's very exciting to see your vision being both adopted and shaped by enthusiasts that gather around the same principles but have still different opinions. Some people are cheerleaders. Some people are profound thinkers. Some are technical devs. It's a very heterogeneous set of people. I do not, and the fun part is indeed, I do not know almost any of them. So it's indeed catching up. It's bigger than myself by orders of magnitude. I'm happy to be just the originator and just acknowledging the history, but not the person that's running the community. And if there are some peoples to which you can credit the growth of the community and the management, it wouldn't be me. And I'm enjoying that fact and seeing that baby grow and shape its own personality. You have kids, so you'll learn that at a certain point you realize they're not yours. They're just fruits of your hope, but they're not yours. So they get their own personality and they shape themselves, and you're still around, but you're not. You don't really have neither the permission nor the desire to shape them deliberately.
Yeah, I love that lesson. I always go with they didn't decide to be born. We decided. It was almost like a selfish thing. It's, we want to have a kid. They didn't decide that. But they're their own human with their own personality and their own way of eventually living. You just want to create the environment and hope for the best. I like the way that you're thinking about that. Cool, man. We did an hour here. Anything else that you want to talk about just in general with the community, or what you're excited about, or what you're going to try and work on over the next 30 to 60 days here that's right out in front of you?
That's too broad of a question for the few minutes we have. So I guess I just thank you for having me on board, and maybe we can chat another time.